You are now entering the spoiler zone. The following podcast contains explicit plot details and pockets of profanity. You have been warned. The Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in wine and space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss, and this time it's another crossover edition with the boys from the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour. This is an episode we recorded for their podcast, and this time we're discussing the film The Return of Captain Invincible. Take it away, fellas.
Should we get something to eat before the film?
Yeah, can do. Just the usual for me.
Lovely stuff. I'm starving. And the process here is quite simplistic. Excuse me?
All right, lads. What can I get you?
Can I get a hot pod, please?
No worries. Do you want swearing on that?
Yes. Can I have plenty of... a dash of... and a side of...
On its way. Anything to drink?
Yes. All of it in a bucket. At least 43% proof.
Excellent. And do you want any mistakes with your order?
What do you mean?
Well, getting stuff on the mic... non-accurate transmission dates.
What do you think we're here to see?
Coming up in this afternoon's lovely cinematographical soiree.
My first exposure to this delightful piece of cinematography was when it landed entirely legitimately on my doormat about a week ago. And, well, yeah, it's certainly a film.
I tell you what's achievable. You can get a supporting actress who looks like Petula Clark to appear in the film. That's what you can do.
Here we get 8 solid minutes of needlessly lengthy exposition cut over 4 scenes where I think editor John Scott must have gone out to the toilet.
So he was involved in the film and he didn't appear in vision. What a waste.
If you had the option, you know, you wouldn't either. That's if you right. stepped on set and saw that going on, you'd be like, I'll be over there in a bin bag.
Exit, stage left.
Are you all right? Hello and welcome to the Peggy Mount Sunday Matinee Hour. I'm Dr. Velvet.
I'm Blackout.
And we're here to crack open a cassette casing of the VHS video variety in order to view some 1980s cinema on the small screen.
Yes, hello you. Thanks for swinging by for this slipshod, salacious scrutiny of small screen cinema, because there's nothing on the telly, so producer Ken's been down the video shop to rent out the latest blockbuster. If you go over to peggymountpod.com, info and gubbins for the film we're discussing is in the show notes, plus you can find us on the socials, get in touch to say hello, or suggest things that you would like us to cover in the future.
Yes, you really can. Now, there's not just the two of us here. Hells no! Joining us this week are the dynamic duo from the Exton Moss Experiment. Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm grand.
Tickety-boo and a half, gentlemen.
Good, good, good. Simon, I've got for you, I've got the Ruth Maddock blanket that you wanted, so you can put that over your knees while we're watching this.
How did you know?
And Ken, there's the Button Moon pint glass.
Oh, I shall remember this day. Thank you, gentlemen, thank you.
You're very welcome, you're very welcome. In fact, speaking of things to put in a pint glass...
Yes, just before we take umbrage at our superiors and retire to stagger around with a bottle shouting at strangers in the street, I've got to ask, what are we all having to drink?
Gin.
I mean, par for the course. What kind of gin?
It's kind of an odds and ends of bottles that I had left over that I've slung together in a decanter.
You're drinking dregs, aren't you, Simon? You're drinking dregs.
Pretty much. It's quite nice.
I love it.
It's got some bits floating in it, but it's all right.
I love it. Mr. Moss?
Well, I've got a can of something that I have left over from our guest appearance on the Nori Batty Disaster Show. It is the Vocation Brewery Yeasty Boys Breakfast Club Waffle and Blueberry Breakfast Stout. I mean, a snip at 6.9%. I've been saving this for a special occasion. Let's see what it's like.
I'm on the edge of me crackers.
Oh, dear Christ. My eyes are burning. Oh. Wow. That's, I feel like I should be sat on a park bench. Wow.
A recommendation? Should I ask you later in A&E?
All this fuss about something you can actually buy and he still wants to try Squatter's Cocktail at some point.
It might be similar, actually. What you're drinking there, the effect, might be similar to what I'm having. Brace yourself.
What are you drinking?
Taboo and Coke.
Taboo?
There you go.
They still make it.
There you go. Taboo, the 80s liqueur, with its partner in crime, Mirage, if you remember, okay?
Yes.
Now, you see, I remember being stood at a bar in my local town on a Friday night in 1989. I distinctly remember this, waiting to be served. A woman in front of me ordered Taboo and Coke, and I'll never forget the barman saying, "Coke? With Taboo? That sounds shit, that!" And I've always meant to try it. So I am, and I have, and it is. Blackout, what are you drinking?
Well, I have got a bottle of Mio IPA from the St. Ives Brewery. I've been to St. Ives, that's what it is.
Nice. Sorry, what was the name of it?
Mio, as in Port Mio, which is one of the beaches in St. Ives.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
As opposed to Tony Mio.
Nice little local craft ale.
I mean, it's not terribly local to you.
Well, it was when I was there.
And with that, gentlemen, it is up, up and away as we go from shit-faced solitude to sensible sobriety in spandex in the form of this comic book-themed offering of yore. Look up to the screen. Is it a well-composed musical? Is it a clever parody? No! It's the return of Captain Invincible.
Yes, The Return of Captain Invincible is an Australian 1983 musical fantasy satire written by Andrew Gatey and Stephen E. D'Souza, directed by Philippe Mora. It stars Alan Arkin as the eponymous superhero, gifted his powers by an alien intervention and used to great effect by the US government during the Second World War before he was hounded out of the country during the Red Scare of the 1950s. After lying down and out for decades in Australia, Cap is brought out of retirement by Patty Petria, played by Kate Fitzpatrick, a police officer who urges him to help when America is being threatened by his old nemesis, Mr. Midnight, the magnificent Sir Christopher Lee, who has stolen a secret government hypno-ray and begun using it for nefarious ends. But in order to save the world, Captain Invincible will have to start by conquering his very worst enemy, himself, and just maybe singing a few songs along the way. So, this had a small and somewhat troubled release in 1983, before finding its way to the fledgling home video market. I don't think anyone really saw it back in that day, so instead I'll ask, when was the return of Captain Invincible first brought to your attention?
About 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, for me, it was about the beginning of the year when it came through on our production list. So there you are. I'd never heard of this. I'd never heard of this, which is odd for me.
I saw it in the late 80s. And it was one of the films that I saw when I went to the Brighton World Science Fiction Convention.
Right.
And other than Christopher Lee slinking around in leather and singing, I didn't remember an awful lot about it.
Was it presented in a sort of tongue-in-cheek fashion?
It was just, here's a video room. If you fancy watching it, watch it. If you don't, don't.
And what about yourself, Ken? Is this your first time?
You never forget your first time. My first exposure to this delightful piece of cinematography was when it landed entirely legitimately on my doormat about a week ago. And, it's certainly a film.
Isn't it, though?
Well, it's worth pointing out before we lay into it.
Yeah.
Captain Invincible had a budget of $7 million. For comparison, 1978's Superman, the film which clearly inspired the production of this, had a budget of $55 million. Mm. Now, what do we really think is achievable when the production crew are handed 12% of the money needed to make the thing they've just been shown?
They can... I'll tell you what's achievable.
Even Condor Man had $14 million thrown at it.
Yeah, I tell you what's achievable. You can get a supporting actress who looks like Petula Clark to appear in the film. That's what you can do. That's what you can do. Anyway, we start very promisingly with this. We start with
she doesn't sing like Petula Clark, though, does she?
With the very best one in the world, when she sings, we don't know what it's like because that's not her voice. That's someone else.
Oh, yes, yes, that's true. It's Hamble from Play School. So, we start with this beautiful movie. A hark back to the cinematic serials of the American 40s. This takes me back, actually, to something I've just watched recently. The 1943 Batman serial that happened. I don't know why it happened. He looked a right prick in it. But what a lovely little montage at the beginning. Well, I say montage. It's 15 solid minutes, man.
Well, this is the thing. It's like we get some newsreel footage showing Captain Invincible fighting crime in the Prohibition area. Then we go to, like, the height of his World War II heyday. We cycle through the congressional hearing where he hangs up his cape. In any other movie, this would be a 90-second catch-up montage sequence.
Yep.
Spinning newspaper headlines, shortcuts, the works. And yeah, here we get 8 solid minutes of needlessly lengthy exposition cut over 4 scenes where I think editor John Scott must have gone out to the toilet.
Was it just the 8 minute, was it?
It's just 8 minutes. It feels like twice that, but yes, it's just 8 minutes.
I'll tell you what, it was educational in a certain way because there's a map during the montage and something's there. There's a word, Buckhaus. Is that German for brothel?
Ah, but there were two in that montage. There was Buckhaus and Fuchhaus.
Ah, I didn't see that, see?
Always keep your eyes on the prize, gentlemen.
Do you know what I mean? Every time. But you're right. In terms of exposition, the newsreel flashbacks, they work. We do see the rise and fall.
Yeah, they work almost in real time.
Yes.
The bit where he's sitting in the front of the plane, he just looks like an utter tool.
Yes, he does.
I think that's intentional.
It is.
Well, you would hope so.
But, I mean, yeah, you know, there's a lot of... Again, this section is very... sort of tongue-in-cheek, both of the genre that is trying to sort of mimic now, plus the newsreel footage of the past. I did like that bit at the very start in the Prohibition clip, where the voiceover goes, "Hidden cameras recorded this sensational scene of bootleggers in action. They must be very well hidden, mate. That opening cuts a fucking crane shot."
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. It is a very tongue-in-cheek. Particularly with... Captain Invincible's aesthetic as well. He reminds me of the George Reeves Superman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, even as a kid, I was not blinded by George Reeves' casting. I always thought he looked like a fart. He didn't cut it for me, ever.
Right.
He didn't, but God rest his soul.
Am I the only person that thought Alan Arkin looked like Robert Downey Jr.?
Yes.
Yes.
How much did you had to drink that day when you were watching it?
I wasn't on this battery acid, but I was. Yeah. Just me then.
I did exclaim when he first appeared because my movie going days are over. I'm not a big cinema fan. I'm more TV. I screamed, "Oh, it's Peggy's husband from Edward Scissorhands!" In my ignorance. Uh-huh. That's where it sort of clicked with me, but yeah.
I'm just going to put it out on Front Street. I do enjoy Arkin's performance in this. He shouts his way through every scene, but that's Alan Arkin. He clearly thinks he's going to be in a better film, and I admire his optimism.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, I've no problems with his performance. Even when we cut to present day after this montage.
Well, just before we do... What I wanted to say is that I did actually quite like the McCarthy style hearings that were right at the end. They went on a bit too long, but they really kind of pre-shadowed the kind of anti-hero stuff that we're getting nowadays with things like The Boys. I'm sure that wasn't deliberate, but
this
I thought it
comes
was,
up
it was
later
done quite
in
well.
My notes. Yes, there are various things that this film does, which is like. Slightly ahead of its time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after this lengthy backstory, Then we get another 2 minutes of William Motzing's swooping orchestral score and helicopter shots over a title sequence.
Yeah.
2 minutes. Has the editor been told he's not getting paid if the film comes out under an hour and a half?
it's lack of a script. Our beloved captain on top of a cliff, mind us pissed and singing at the top of his lungs while a helicopter circles him. I mean, we've all been there, haven't we? Haven't we?
I think that's where the budget went on the fuel for the helicopter, the number of passes it does.
About 75 grand down payment to get a helicopter out, you know?
I think Captain Invincible had just seen the promo poster for the film and realised he was the bastard love child of Sam Neill and Bjorn Ulvaeus. Because I don't know what photo image they were using, but that is not Alan Arkin on that picture.
And the pose was a little bit Flesh Gordon, wasn't it?
Again, intentional, I would imagine, but yeah.
I never saw that, Flesh Gordon. I remember seeing posters for that not long after Flash Gordon outside the Odeon in Newcastle upon Tyne City Centre. And I never got to see that. I must have been about 8, so I never got to see that at the time.
If you bear in mind when we used to get videos out of Ritz, they had it on the shelf then.
Did they?
And we would always like pick up the case and then put it back and then get something else.
See?
It doesn't have the production values of this.
Good God.
Right, right.
But it is quite funny.
Okay.
And the Penosaurus has to be seen to be believed.
The whole way through this film, you know, having only known of it for a few days now, the whole way through the film, all I was thinking was, this is like some crazy mashup between Superman, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Plan 9 from Outer Space. It was.
I think you've been reading my notes, Ken.
I think you've been reading mine as well. Yes, I think you have. Yes, that's insane. Okay, we're all on the same page then. All right, story-wise, cut to Manhattan with a fabulous narrator and a lovely zoom shot of Chris Lee. This is quite well stylized, I think.
A lot of the actual cinematography in it isn't too bad. The editing is absolutely all over the shot.
Oh.
But some of the shots themselves and some of the lighting behind it...
Done with a rolling pin.
Yeah.
But in this beginning, this film is very self-aware. At this point.
Yes, yeah.
It knows what it wants to be, and it knows what it has to do, and it's cracking on. Christopher Lee starts singing, and this is something to watch for, despite anything else. And I get the
feeling... Is this the bit where he starts singing for no reason?
Yes.
He's not doing one of the songs. He's literally just, like, in the middle of a scene, just feels like singing. It's not in the script. No one's going to stop him.
And he just does it. He's loving this. He's loving this because he hasn't got a cape on and fangs in his mouth. So he's loving this.
I'm loving the idea that Captain Invincible has gone missing after being, you know, sort of hounded out of the country, right? Mm-hmm. And the government's put out a request for finding him. And yet when he appeared on some random news report on American television 2 days earlier, looking and sounding precisely like Captain Invincible, no one noticed. As if there's no footage of him from 30 years earlier that we've all just had to sit through. And then a policewoman in Australia, who's never even heard of the man before, recognises him because of a tramp she literally met that morning.
She'd met him quite a few times before, because before she goes along to move him on, it was, this is the same bloke from last week and the week before and the week before. And
you're absolutely
before.
Right, I stand corrected, yes. No one's sort of asked, why is he American? There's absolutely no reason for that. This world-famous superhero, 30 years later, everyone's dead from then.
Yeah.
Did she not recognise him or trigger a thought because a black Volkswagen Beetle dropped from 100 feet in the air about 3 feet from her? And thought, that's a bit curious. That tramp, there's something about him. Now, let me just dig back through the old memories here. Or am I just reading too much into it? I'm just giving it far too much credit.
I don't understand how the two guys in the black Beetle get arrested, basically for trying to murder a police officer. Then they keep showing up in the rest of the film because they've been let out the next day. Why?
Well, obviously, spinal surgery is much better in Australia than it is in England.
Yes.
And they were bailed out by a posh lawyer, because there's the bit in the police station going on about who basically saying, how come these scangers have got a good lawyer?
I see, I missed that. I wasn't, I was too busy banging a tin tray on my head waiting for the film to stop. Yeah.
There's that. Can any of us at this point, certainly Ken, from this at this point in time, if you'd watched this at 10 years old, would you have gone, oh my God, yes, this is great. This is superheroes, this is quite funny, this is quite, we don't know where we're going with this.
That's a very good question. I might have done. You see, bear in mind, what would have been, 6, 7, 8, something like that, I was exposed to Howard the Duck. And I thought it was a wonderful film, but largely because I was, I was sat with the girl next door. And, we had a bit of a thing for each other at that age. So it was just an excuse for me to sit with the girl next door. Maybe Howard the Duck on repeat viewing might not be the classic I thought it was when I was preschool. This, I don't know. It's... The script's a bit all over the place. The dialogue that Christopher Lee's given... this was a man who, certainly by that point, was a giant in the cinema industry. And he was presented with the script and read it with such dynamic, belief in this script, even though it was clearly diabolically shit and didn't make any sense, and he still put his all into it, and it's still dire. And at no point did he turn around... baring his fangs, cape flying in the wind, and saying, "I'm not reading this pile of shite, I'm back." I can't believe he actually did this film. I can't imagine that it's high up on his CV or
was he actually a giant at the time? I think it would have been between peaks of giantness, because he was big in the 70s, early 70s, 60s with the Hammer stuff. And was big again later with the Lord of the Rings stuff. But this would have been a lull in his career, because mm-hmm. this would have been the same year as The House of Long Shadows, with him and John Carradine and Vincent Price and somebody else. And the whole point of that film is harking back to their glory days in the as stars of horror films, and the fact that they weren't anymore. So I'm not sure he would have been a cinema giant at this point in his career.
I agree. I think he's in his lull here.
I think it's also got to be said that as a bit of the Alan Arkin in play, where he's turning up, he's looking at the script, he's giving it his best. Everything after that is down to the editing team. He's done all he can. You rarely stand on a film set. You might get a vibe whether it's going to be good or not, but you rarely know what the finished thing is going to look like. I don't think anyone on that set had the finished product in mind while they were there, because they'd just gone home.
I don't think anybody had in mind the musical bullshit scene conducted by the president of the United States or Australia.
Now this particular scene, this round table where all the military leaders get together and they're discussing the hypno ray and its theft.
Yeah,
this is the absolute crystallization of this film's absolute lack of direction.
Yes, yes.
All of this was shot on the first take with no one having a fucking clue what they were supposed to be doing.
To be fair, this is very important, this shows what can be written under the influence of creme de menthe and tramadol.
Yes. Now, I don't believe in the concept of so bad it's good. We've been over this before.
Yep.
But I will say that Michael Pate's performance as the President of the United States is so horrifically over the top,
yep,
that it instantly becomes the second best thing in the film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can we have a quick clip of the bullshit song?
Bullshit! Bullshit! Bullshit, 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 bullshit! Bullshit, 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 bullshit! Bullshit!
Yeah, I'm sitting there like, what is this? What am I watching? Am I having a stroke?
Well, to be honest, I thought it was that good. I did have a stroke. But it
Well, I don't know who's doing the casting for this scene, but all the female characters look as though they've just wandered in off a porn set, and all of the male characters look as though they've just wandered in from a porn theatre.
Even the one with the robot hand.
If you're unsure when you're sat watching this, what am I watching? This just spells it out, doesn't it? This is everything underlined right now.
You're absolutely right. There is a bookmark to put in here, because we're 19 minutes in and we get our first song.
Yeah.
Immediately followed by We Need a Hero.
Yep.
It's only at this point that we're told this film is a musical. That's quite the reveal.
It really is.
And as we're going to find out, over the course of, like, basically 100 minutes, there's not really enough songs in this for it to be classed as a musical.
No.
But there are far too many for it not to be.
That's right.
We get 9 songs in total, right? 3 of which are written by Richard O'Brien and Richard Hartley from the Rocky Horror Show. 3 of which are written by Brad Love. I say 3. One of those is bullshit. I don't think that counts. The other 3 have been penned by 6 writers between them, and they're all in massively different styles. None of this hangs together. Uh-huh. The only thing that links these songs is that they're on the same soundtrack album.
I did mention Kate Fitzpatrick. Bearing a striking resemblance to Petula Clark. Depending on the light, she also looks like Ailsa from Home and Away.
Are you suggesting that after this she changed her name and went into daytime soaps?
She was Nell Mangle's stunt double in Neighbours.
Ah, right.
As a kind of witness protection programme.
That kind of thing.
Something like that, yeah.
Just while we're on the subject of the songs, Christopher Lee sings a song.
Yeah.
To disable an alcoholic by unveiling a bar and offering him drinks.
It's possibly one of the highlights of the film for me.
It's the highlight of the film, but yes, go on.
Did Christopher Lee actually... Were there any practice runs with Christopher Lee singing, or did they just... Give it your best shot, Chris. See how it comes out.
I was going to say his direction may well have been give it your best shot, try for opera, and remember Rex Harrison couldn't sing either.
Well, bear in mind, you know, he's not singing that on the set. That's pre-recorded.
That's right.
That recorded version is the final version. He's just miming to that. That's fine. I'm absolutely 100% okay with it. And it's all very well thinking that Richard O'Brien's involvement in this, you know, it might lift the production after his 1975 masterwork, The Rocky Horror Picture Show. But don't forget that by this point, he'd gone on to make Shock Treatment in 1981. That is the O'Brien that we get here.
So hang on a minute. I've gone on about this being like a mashup between The Rocky Horror Picture Show and Plan 9 from Outer Space. Richard O'Brien actually was involved in this.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes, he wrote three of the songs. He wrote 3 of the songs. He sings on one of them.
Yep.
What?
Yeah.
We'll get to that. It's near the end. It's
so
fine.
He was involved in the film, and he didn't appear in Vision. What a waste.
If you had the option, you know, you wouldn't either. That's if you right. stepped on set and saw that going on, you'd be like, I'll be over there in a bin bag.
Being hit by baseball bats.
I'll tell you what, I'll be operating one of them Hoovers. That's fine for me.
Oh!
Anyway, we're getting ahead. We're getting ahead.
The Hoover scene. This is...
We're getting ahead.
Absolutely incredible, but yes, we're getting ahead. This film can go anywhere. We cut from a scene where folk end up in partial undress due to some kind of magnetic power that the protagonist has, followed directly by a covert little person dressed as Red Riding Hood hidden behind a car outside. It's crackers, this. This film's crackers. Absolutely nuts.
So that we skip over to downtown Sydney, where Captain Invincible.
That's why it's Petula Clark.
There we go. And we get like a very kind of like mournful country number from Alan Arkin, which again, in and of itself, it's a decent song. It just doesn't really belong in this film, and it doesn't fit in with anything else.
But I was riveted. In fact, I didn't want to leave the screen.
What I want to know is, how come when the president turns up,
the president of the United States of America?
How come when he turns up, right? That kid in the Second World War footage who just keeps dropping in that he's going to be president one day, he's got to be what? 8, 10 years old at the outside?
Yep.
Now, America joined the war effort in 1941, which means that when he turns up as the actual president in the early 80s, Michael Pate's character is supposed to be around 40 years old. Where was his paper round? Death Valley.
Clive Swift. That's all I'll say.
Actually, Michael Pitt was born in 1920, so he was 63 when this film was released. It's not like, you know, that's just miscasting. Really, that's all there is to it.
I think his mouth was being operated by animatronics. It was completely independent from the rest of his face.
So this whole idea, like you were saying, about this washed-up superhero... He's rehearsing his like forgotten shtick in front of his like a personal trailer and a press team and these government officials. It all feels very ahead of its time for 1983, where like the heroes here are as valuable for their PR presence as they are their superpowers, their assets rather than people. Now, Return of Captain Invincible landed 2 years before Watchmen, and the deconstruction of the genre on screen didn't really start for about another 15 years. I'm not saying that this film is a trailblazer, but it was doing things in 1983 for which there wasn't yet an audience.
Yeah.
Which is worth bearing in mind in some of its moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Have you got to the Hoover bit yet?
Well, no, because there's the falling off the bar training montage bit yet, which was quite a nice take on the kind of Rocky-style training montages that you got sick to death of in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
That was 76, am I right?
Yes.
Did Rocky ever chew the edge off somebody's bar?
I mean, you know, what goes on in the training room stays in the training room.
I mean, it's very hammily done, but there is a strong subplot here about addiction and self-defeat and mania. And in different hands, this film could have had a lot more to say. And again, it just falls at that hurdle. It's just, you know, is it a comedy? Is it a drama? No, it's Alan Arkin biting a chunk out of the formica. Fair enough, there we go. Right, all because he's literally just seen a bottle. And then we get Petula Clark badly miming to a song.
It's very rare for me to be speechless on a podcast, but this I mean, let's be fair, it's not very exciting listening if you're just so stunned by what you've watched that you can't actually comment on it. But this
was... Is it?
Do the rest of your notes just say... Bullshit. Bullshit. Bullshit, 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 bull, bullshit, shit, shit.
With some great clamshell mouth. And I'm trying desperately to cling on to bits of the film that I quite... There's one bit that I thought was quite clever, that was quite nice, didn't make any sense, but it was there, that Captain Invincible's secret lair is in the head of the Statue of Liberty, hence why it's been closed off for 30 years. Thought that was quite nice. Now, why he'd got so pissed that he'd forgotten this, flown off to Australia and stood waving his arms on a cliff for 3 decades, was better than living in the Statue of Liberty. I don't know.
It's not even that. It's the fact that he's been missing for 30 years and no one's repossessed the flat. All of his stuff is just there, untouched. The tour guide says sort of earlier on, because they're like, oh, can we go up into the head of the Statue of Liberty? And the tour guide's like, no, they closed that off years ago. So it kind of sets up that something's going to be done with it. But you're like, well, everyone's going to know that that's his gaff, right? You know, really. It's not like he's triple padlocked it and then welded the door shut. Come on.
Would this be the tour guide who is one of the regulars from Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In?
Oh, well spotted.
He's done his alumni research. Oh, God.
Hasn't there he? Isn't much. But before we get to the Hoover, we've got his origin story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you see, I didn't write anything about that. Bang, there we go. Origin, black and white what? Origin story. Weird, pervy aliens dogging.
No, it was alien porn. It was the aliens watching them shag, and then all finishing at the same time and having a ciggy.
Yeah, the weirdest thing, it might be like Patty going, so how did all this start? What was the beginning of all this Captain Invincible? And he goes, well, it's a long story. And then it isn't. It's like a 1 minute montage. It's shorter than his fucking war years.
It's a long story, wanking aliens.
Yeah.
Oh, are we going to ignore the elephant in the room in this film? Oh, come on, let's get to the scene where the Hoovers fillet each other to death.
Then...
Yes?
Captain Invincible...
Yes?
...and Patty...
Yes?
...get attacked by a shop full of Hoovers.
Here we go.
Because of course they do.
This was incredible.
At least the special effects team were having fun that day. What the fuck?
Well, somebody'd seen John Pertwee's phone cable scene, hadn't they?
They had. Absolutely that. Oh, I've seen this on Doctor Who somewhere. Have you? Oh, by the way, give us another go of that glue bag while we create this. And off they went. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No fucks given at all.
Is it explained in the film, bearing in mind I've watched it twice, is it explained in the film why they're in a Hoover shop? I'm allowed to say Hoover and not vacuum cleaner because there are like massive actual branded Hoover stickers all over the place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why? What led them into that?
No, you. Just why? Why? You just needed to stop there.
None of this made any sense.
It's just a missing reel, isn't there?
Yeah.
We're sitting here trying to work it out. No, it's always been like that, mate.
Yeah. Good God.
We managed to lose the fight with the Hoovernator, and then his minions came in. That's where the film picks up again. Yeah, I'm sorry if it was confusing.
By the time we're in disguise down the drain, I'm bored with this film. It's running out of steam. But
it's running out of steam. It was at full pelt up to this point.
As well as having seen John Pertwee's phone cable scene, Captain Invincible talks about reversing the polarity.
Polarity, yes, he does. Yes, he does.
You've mentioned the editing of this film earlier on, that it was done with a blunt axe in the dark.
Uh-huh.
But who was the lighting cameraman on this thing? Because the scenes vary from a 15-watt bulb to a magnesium strip set on fire.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes, they do.
The only time the lighting is remotely acceptable is when you're in Christopher Lee's lair. Yes. And even then, it's just like, you'll get like a fantastic silhouette shot, but then he'll start speaking, and you're like, are we not meant to be able to see his face for this bit? No, it's still just a silhouette, is it? Fine, okay, carry on.
I genuinely think this was filmed chronologically, and by the point that we're talking at now, everyone had just thought, I can't be fucking arsed with this. Should we just crack on?
Except that animatronic vulture was the best special effect in the whole thing and probably cost half the budget.
Yeah.
Well, better than the Hoovers.
It looked like something it really looked like something out of the Dark Crystal. It was massively underused, but I thought it was great.
The cafe shootout was decent. I want that fish gun as a water pistol. But who doesn't like a cake fight? It was like a nod to Bugsy Malone, this.
It was indeed.
You see, it didn't work for me. The combination of bullets and custard pies, no. Yeah. Although I did quite like the visual gag where they had a metal copy of the symbol pie that they throw and knock it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you notice who the man behind the counter was?
Frank Pickle.
It was Frank Pickle.
So traumatised by this, by being one of the Super Mario brothers with a fish gun, that he decided to have a nervous breakdown and go and be the parish clerk in Dibley Village.
And he'd also been Commander Zero in Fireball XL5.
Was he
really?
Was he in that? I didn't know that.
He was. And after this, he went on and appeared in the Torch for Silverado episode of Virtual Murder.
Oh! Got to say, I'm slightly disappointed that we're, in terms of the film, we're back in New York now. Mm. And none of you have mentioned that lovely back projection scene as Captain Invincible flies at what appears to be about 30 miles an hour from Sydney to New York, a distance of just under 16,000 miles.
Right?
Like, Patty's not going to be dead of exposure on his back.
they're not even pretending to make that realistic, because she's there sort of shuffling around, reading, sorting through things in her handbag.
Uh-huh.
That really was quite shit.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, if it had flown there in half an hour, she would have been charcoal within about 3 seconds. So probably the 30... Split the difference.
Split the difference, yeah. And she probably did on landing.
So it becomes pretty much spelled out by this point what Mr. Midnight is actually doing.
Yeah.
He's using the stolen hypno ray to convince New York's citizens of immigrant and ethnic minority stock to move into these new housing estates in the shadow of Ellis Island. Then he's going to kill them all to make the city pure. Now, that's a pretty fucking bold storyline for 1983.
Rather.
Mm. And he's kidnapped Hot Gossip.
Yeah. So am I right in thinking that it's completely intentional that when Mr. Midnight says the words "the pure genetic Americans," he's deliberately misunderstood the fact that modern America was built on immigration and the original people he's referring to are largely dead because of just that? Like, he's not the first one to have carried out this plan. Once you remove all of the groups that Mr. Midnight is planning to round up, all that's left is people of British ancestry. This is like an intentionally satirical point, isn't it? Because no one in the screenplay mentions it at all, and this is not a film of subtlety. So,
And it, in retrospect, it is a bit Brexity.
Oh, God, here we go. God, put your tin hat on. Fucking hell, into the air raid shelter.
To be fair, it's entirely set up when you see Hitler in the first sort of 3 minutes. It's just not referred to that that's what's going on.
No, it is.
Actually, there was a thing I wanted to, a final thing I wanted to mention about the scene in the deli, which is where he's doing his "I Want to Be Frank Sinatra" song at the end, just before he falls down the manhole or whatever. Patty's face is just an absolute picture of what the fuck are you doing? It is so
unimpressed. Become a member of the audience at this point.
It is just, for Christ's sake. Ken, when I talk about resting bitch face, that's what that was.
I'm getting there.
And then he spends about a million years falling down this hole. It must have gone three times around the centre of the earth before it got to Captain Midnight or Mr. Midnight's headquarters.
You've got my notes here, haven't you? Go on.
Where he's greeted by the cast of the League of Gentlemen.
Oh, I thought you were going to have the... I've got the, like, he falls miles under the surface of New York. He's fallen. And when he gets to the bottom, there's daylight coming in through the windows. Okay, mate.
Yeah.
And he's falling downwards, and his cloak is flowing backwards as well.
And then, finally, we get to the only section that anyone knows from this film, and deservedly so.
Might I say that I'm old-fashioned, très fan ordinaire. So highball the vodka and name your sting. Be a big shot with a bull shot. Be a swine, meet a pine. Have a shot or a pot or a snort of any sort. Asti spumante.
Now, I think it's clear that more focus has gone into this segment than the rest of the film combined. Apart from anything else, if a song full of bad puns and tortured rhymes about idolies and booze doesn't just scream the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour, then I don't know what does.
Right, absolutely that.
It would have been better if it wasn't sung through a wet sponge so that we could have actually understood the lyrics. It was a little... I was picking through the bones of the words. Sorry.
Did you look up the lyrics online?
No.
Look up the lyrics online and then listen to the song again. And it makes sense when you can see what the words are. The problem is it works better on the page than it does sung out loud.
Yes.
It's very, very nicely written. It's just, the performance and everything. I'm prepared to forgive it because I love it, but it... Yeah, you really need the bouncing dot at the bottom of the screen and the words.
And tonic.
Again, I'll just say it now. The phrase, if you don't name your poison, I'll have to get the boys in,
yes,
is the best lyric of all time. It is, never in a million years would I write that. It is fucking outstanding.
Well, they were very proud of that line because it got repeated about 8 times.
Rightly so. And yes, this is one of the ones written by Richard O'Brien and Richard Hartley from off of the Rocky Horror Show. And it's at this point that the film is the closest to Rocky Horror and the closest it gets to being what it wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was shown to the investors before it was made, and they all thought all of it was going to be like this, so they threw the money down for it, yeah. Well, the big set piece is done now. Captain Invincible recovers from his alcoholic stupor by hearing Kate Smith sing God Bless America, because that's all that's been needed for 3 decades, apparently. Mr. Midnight legs it and destroys his own bar with rockets that were pointing right into the room for some reason.
Leaps into a pair of waders.
Yeah,
they go off down into the basement. And it's only at this point, 93 minutes into the film, does the hero realise what the villain is actually trying to achieve. So, he blows up a control panel using his magnetic power. He knocks Mr. Midnight over into his paddling pool with a giant beach ball. Then he blows up Mr. Midnight's submarines using the same magnets. This film has a fucking weird idea of how magnets work. Yeah. And that's it. That's the end. That is the end of the film. This could all have been fixed an hour and a half ago with magnets.
Yep.
Good Lord. We get a stirring speech as he flies around New York at night.
Oh, yeah.
Which leads to the final song, which is the Captain Invincible theme, which is sung by Richard O'Brien.
Yes.
And we get the credits, and that version of it incorporates a sort of knockoff version of Peter Gunn, which it's all very odd.
It was very Peter Gunn, wasn't it?
Is this just enough out of copyright to be usable? Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah, God.
I think by this point the catatonia must have set in, because I don't remember any of what you've just said.
You lucky bastard.
Yeah,
I just remember the drink song, and then a bit of Shash, and then the end credits, and that's basically what the edit is in my head.
Am I safe to say that there we are, gentlemen? That's it. That's us. That's our thoughts.
I think it is.
The return of Captain Invincible. Good Lord.
I have two more comments.
Go for it.
Firstly, the 12-year-old child in me sniggered every time I heard Legend in Leotard.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
And my final comment is that this film boasts a Doctor Who alumnus.
Oh, who have we got?
Yeah.
Bill Hunter, and I can't remember what he played in the film, was one of the Guardians in the first half of the arc.
Okay.
Boom, there we go. That's why we get the experts in.
And where are they then?
Now.
I love the Ark.
The Ark, a Doctor Who story that's two insurance write-offs welded together. Much like this film.
Yeah.
This film, as a final note, it's like someone's picked up a lot of different bits of other films that were just left lying around, crudely welded them together into some sort of weird Australian homunculus and thought, that'll do.
Again, you're reading my notes.
Yes. And again, yes, that's your Plan 9 comparison, and damned accurate.
And you have to realise that the 80s was the time of trauma. You compare this to something like
The Sullivans,
Rabid Grannies or something, then it has better production values and pretty much everything.
Anyway, Mr. Moss, how many pegs on the line are you going to give the return of Captain Invincible?
Oh, God, really? It was there. I don't think I'm going to profane my DVD player with it anytime soon again. Mm. It was fairly ropey. But it wasn't... I know you've... Blackout, you've gone on about things not being so bad they're good. I think that does fall into this category. It is that bad.
I'm not saying it isn't that bad. I'm not saying it's that bad that it's good.
No, it isn't. I won't be racing back to this. I think because it was taped together with blue tack and copy decks and just then put through a Play-Doh masher. Two.
Dr. Exton.
Well, this really took me back to the time of trauma and all of those really low-budget 80s films, which were quite a lot of fun. I quite enjoyed this, and I'm going to give it a 7. Wallop. And I will be watching this again.
There you go.
Good God, man!
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Fair play.
Fair play, yeah, absolutely. I imagine Blackout's got about 7 pages on his final thoughts. Minor brief. I will say that 10-year-old me in 1983 would have wanted to love this. I would have got it. The parody, the silliness. And I really would have got the parody. But then again, it wasn't being aimed at me. If this is literally Stan Lee and Richard O'Brien going on the piss for 3 days without sleep, this is the result. I have to revert to the classic answer of, I can see what you're trying to do, but you're not quite there. A generous 5 pegs from me.
See, I feel like a right bastard now. I'm on Team Ken with this one. The return of Captain Invincible is a sort of retooling of the Captain America story in reaction to Richard Donner's Superman, while pre-channeling Crocodile Dundee in the style of Rocky Horror. Now, I very much put this on the same shelf as Howard the Duck. It was made at the wrong time before it could be done properly. There's a lot of potential there, and it has so much ambition. Unfortunately, nobody on set or behind the scenes has a fucking clue how to make this work. It's intriguing, but it's deeply flawed. 3 out of 9.
Fair. 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 However, the question that every recovering alcoholic superhero wants to know, Mr. Blackout, is... how many steps will it take you to don a cape and fly up the mountain?
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. Captain Invincible is played by Alan Arkin, of course, who appeared in Gross Point Blank with Minnie Driver, who was in a 1992 episode of Lovejoy next to Chris Drury, who was in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, of course, alongside Peggy Mount.
That woman can't be next. She's only been here 5 minutes.
Well done. Well done.
And now I shall pass the super baton to Ken. How many steps, sir?
I'm going to kangaroo bounce up the mountain in but 2, you Ooh. Flaming galahs. Starring opposite our hero is Sir Christopher Lee, who was in the 2000 adaptation of Gormenghast with Spike Milligan, who sat on Jack Parr's sofa for a 1960 episode of The Tonight Show next to Peggy Mount.
None at all, I'm only here with a friend.
Beautifully done.
Yep.
How about yourself, Dr. Velvet?
I could do this in a shitface 3. Relegated to third fiddle in this outing is Kate Fitzpatrick, who appeared in the 1997 straight-to-VHS bonanza Emmerdale, The Dingles Down Under, alongside Steve Hallowell, who had a stint in the first run of All Creatures Great and Small, as did Dee Sadler, who also shared the stage for The Greatest Show in the Galaxy with Egg Eagle.
Now let me cast my mind back.
Textbook. Which only leaves the incomparable Dr. Exton.
Well, I can also do it in 3.
Oh, aha.
Playing perhaps the least believable US president ever here is Michael Pate, who somehow landed the role again in 1987's Howling 3, where he played opposite... Barry Humphries as Dame Edna Everidge, who starred in 1978 Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band with... Donald Pleasence, who was of course given a punishment without crime by... the invincible Peggy Mount.
But I'm told it can be fatal.
Nice.
Very nice. Very
beautiful.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Bang tidy.
We have to apologise to any vegans listening for that cow that was kicked down the stairs during that.
That, I will have you know, is my grandmother's prize cowbell. That had a pride of place on her mantelpiece for as long as I remember. Fuck knows why, because it's not decorative or anything, but... loud.
It's loud, it's loud. Love it. Oh, and do you know what? That signals... There you go, it does. It signals the end of this week's episode. That's gentlemen. A huge thank you to Simon and Ken from the Exton Moss Experiment podcast. Gentlemen, where can our listener find you?
We're on SoundCloud and iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcasts and pretty much every platform out there, so just search us out. But yeah, we're very much like the Nora Batty disaster experience, only less well researched.
I mean, you say that, but no, they're very well researched. Can I just say But there you go. Make sure you check out their further adventures. And speaking of the socials that they've just mentioned, Blackout's got ours.
Yes, thanks once again for being with us. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email peggymountpod@gmail.com or we are at peggymountpod on Twitter. You can also find us by searching for the Peggy Mount Calamity on Facebook. Don't forget to go to peggymountpod.com to check out the show notes and to browse all of our other episodes.
It's as simple as that. It really is. Now, I'm going to eject, and then I think I shall be kind, and I'm going to rewind. Thank you for listening to the last 5 weeks of Cinematic Cynicism. We'll be back very soon on the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour. So, until the next time, keep mounting!
Well, wasn't that lovely? Thank you very much to Blackout and Dr. Velvet for asking us back yet again. It's always fun. Next time, Simon and I will be looking at Doctor Who, The Face of Evil, in memoriam of the writer Chris Boucher. Until then, thank you as ever for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. Ta-ta. The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.